You want me to wear this?
Okay.
Okay. So what else causes white dots on MRI besides ischemic small vessels? I'm sorry? We'll get to calcifications later. Okay. Anything else? Okay. Abscesses are usually round with a wall of, you know, reactive inflammatory cells. So gliosis is one possibility. And what leads to gliosis other than infarction?
Inflammation.
Okay, good. Okay. So what do you want to do for this patient? Now, you've heard the story. You can, well, okay, lumbar puncture. Okay, and what do you think you're going to find in a lumbar puncture? Okay, and what will that tell you?
No.
Okay. Okay, so there you go. The opening pressure is somewhat elevated. I'm sorry, I don't remember the number. CSF, lymphocytic pleocytosis, 60 to 80 cells in that range. Protein is elevated. Okay. Anything else on there of interest to you? Okay. Now where are we going? Okay. Fine. Okay. I'm not good at these, but I believe this is a right paratracheal node, and this is the sort of parotid and lacrimal glands lighting up on a gallium scan of the chest and head. Okay. Also characteristic of that disorder. Okay, so this is an interesting lady. She was very difficult to manage, so she had these recurring bouts of aseptic meningitis, and each time she kind of seemed to get worse cognitively as well, and her vision got worse. And so she'd get admitted to the hospital, she'd get some IV steroids, she'd get a little bit better, and we'd send her out on oral steroids, and she'd forget to take them or had some other psychosocial issues, and she'd come back. She ended up for a while being followed by the rheumatology clinic, who arranged for pulse Cytoxan as an outpatient. And she stabilized for a while and then was again sort of lost to follow-up, but ultimately ended up becoming demented, having severe endocrine problems. And the last couple of years, she's been followed at ophthalmology clinic, and she's pretty much blind. So didn't do very well. Okay. Second case, this is a young man who was here a little more than a year ago. He has a history of a stroke and some sort of behavioral problems, which we didn't have a lot of details about, but he presented with altered mental status and trouble walking. In terms of the stroke, he had been admitted at Montefiore in 2005. I'm sorry, I left out how he presented with I think an ataxic hemiparesis that was relatively mild, and he got better. At that time, he had a workup that revealed some calcification in the brain and the basal ganglia and the cerebellar regions, and he had an acute posterior circulation infarct in the midbrain and thalamus. He had an extensive workup there, which was basically negative, except that he was noted to be ANA positive, and nothing much was done. He ended up taking no medications, and when he came back to see us, he was afebrile with normal vital signs. Again, some cognitive problems, poor attention and memory impairment. He had dysarthria. In terms of motor exam, he had full strength but increased tone in the legs, and he was uncoordinated in terms of finger-to-nose testing, things like that. He had hyperreactive reflexes and a gait disorder with both spasticity and ataxia, and he really didn't even want to try to walk for us. Okay. So I will just show you some of his imaging. Way of doing this. here we go. Okay, so this is his brain. You can see in the cerebellum, the white stuff here is calcium. I'm sorry. Okay, so that one. No, it's okay. You know, you can see the basal ganglia is also densely calcified, and this extends up into the subcortical white matter. Quite a bit. Okay, in terms of acute imaging, he showed this little small infarct in the left posterior periventricular area and another left anterior frontal lobe infarct. Okay, and on MRI, he had a brainstem lesion on the right, and again on the right, and on the left, a little bit higher in the midbrain, and up in the white matter, you can see his lesions. So lots of brain disease in this man. Okay. Okay, so the rest of his workup. His SED rate didn't start off quite that high. I'm compressing his hospital course, but it was at least 80 when he came in and went up as high as 120. His creatinine was worse than his prior baseline. Both ANA and double-strand DNA were positive, but not terribly high. The anticardiolipin antibody did come back positive as well. Because of the problem with his legs, he also went for an MRI of the spinal cord and had no detectable abnormality there. And the concern for a possible cerebral vasculitis was raised because of the strokes and the high SED rate, and he had a cerebral angiogram, which did not show anything obviously or severely abnormal, but there was the suggestion of some slight irregularity in some of the distal vessels that is compatible with some type of vasculopathy, but not necessarily vasculitis. Okay. All right, so I just... So he was treated with IV steroids because of the renal disease. Rheumatology and renal were involved and thought that he should be given IVIG and then CellCept. Because of the anticardiolipin antibodies and strokes, he was started on warfarin. So he got a lot of therapies, but didn't benefit much, and had worsening cognitive problems, dementia, and paraparesis. And after 3 or 4 weeks of evaluation and treatment here, he went in poor neurologic condition to a skilled nursing facility. So obviously these are difficult cases. So I wanted to use them just as a springboard for talking about just inflammatory disease of the central nervous system and peripheral nervous system as well. Okay, so just in terms of how do we think about these things? Well, as neurologists, we see a lot of these patients with just MS, or we're having a run on neuromyelitis optica here. And occasionally we'll see monophasic illnesses as opposed to those recurring illnesses that include acute disseminated encephalomyelitis, or just optic neuritis, or just transverse myelitis. And so you guys don't hear about those cases that much. We generally manage those primary conditions. But there are a lot of times when the nervous system is involved with other inflammatory autoimmune diseases that affect other organ systems. And so I want to touch a little bit on those situations. And, you know, that includes true vasculitides as well as other less clearly defined pathologic entities. We had a case recently where he talked a lot about paraneoplastic disorders. Those are, in essence, autoimmune diseases triggered by neoplasms, and they can affect other organs, but including the nervous system. And I'm not going to talk about infections and immune reconstitution, which is, in fact, a good example of this. Okay. Okay, so I put in the first three sort of in bold because I thought those three is what we would talk about. So the neuropsychiatric manifestations of lupus, Sjogren's, and sarcoid. There's some overlap in terms of the antiphospholipid syndrome. We'll talk about that when we talk about lupus a little bit, but that can obviously be a primary abnormality with many neurologic manifestations. You guys might think of some of these other diseases in terms of other manifestations, but I would just highlight something like rheumatoid arthritis has a very high percentage of peripheral nerve manifestations, overwhelming majority. If you look hard for it, we'll have either diffuse polyneuropathy or mononeuritis multiplex. Okay, and so some of their pain is coming from the joint, but some of it's coming from their nerves too. Obviously, there's a whole range of vasculitides, which are generally broken down by the size of the vessel. We think of giant cell arteritis, Takayasu's. And the typical manifestations neurologically there are, with giant cell, you're worried about visual loss, so but other cranial nerves can be affected as well, vestibulocochlear nerve and others, extraocular nerves and muscles. And more rarely, you can have a stroke. And then some of the other vasculitides have a greater predilection for peripheral nerves. So you can end up with multiple peripheral nerve lesions, like a mononeuritis multiplex or a cranial nerve disorder, and much more rarely cause true parenchymal CNS disorders. Okay. Okay, and there's just any range of possible clinical presentations. I mean, just think from top to bottom of the nervous system, everything in the middle and along the way can be affected. I won't belabor that, but okay. So, in terms of lupus, and I just wanted to highlight that there's been some consensus criteria now of what is neuropsychiatric lupus, and this might be an underestimate, but there are 19 syndromes that are now described. If I have it right, there's 12 CNS and 7 PNS manifestations. So we can go through them: aseptic meningitis, stroke, demyelinating disease, headache, which can be either migrainous or other. Movement disorders in chorea would be the most common. Spinal cord disease with myelopathy, seizures, acute confusional state, anxiety, and mood disorder. Cognitive dysfunction that isn't quite bad enough to be necessarily dementia, but can include that more severe spectrum, and more psychiatric disorders. That's fine. Okay, in terms of the peripheral, I'm sorry. We've seen a few patients here with a Guillain-Barré-like illness. It can be just autonomic dysfunction, again, single or multiplex mononeuropathy. Myasthenia gravis can be seen, just cranial neuropathies, and these other peripheral manifestations. Okay. So this is a busy slide, and we can't read it. So basically, I'll just highlight headache is the bottom row. This is the percentage of patients with headache, seizures was second, visual failure, fatigue, memory impairment, hemiparesis, confusion, personality change, depression, and then getting into these lesser things. So in any case, a very high percentage of patients will have these things. Okay. So, stepping back, okay, neurologic disease, how common is it in a lupus patient? Well, that's the problem with this whole literature, and why I want to talk about it is that you get one perspective from maybe someone in rheumatology and a different perspective from someone in neurology. Probably about half the patients have some neurologic manifestation. If you want to find a low number, you can find a low number. If you want to find a high number, you can find 90% of patients. Okay. It's unusual to present with a purely neurologic syndrome. Okay, that's low single digits. Although I think it's a little bit higher if you say there might be systemic and neurologic symptoms close together, close to presentation. It's going to be probably closer to 10%. Okay. Overall, I mean, the worst prognostic thing in lupus is renal failure, but neuropsychiatric manifestations are the second worst in terms of just functional outcome. Okay. And it's really important to know that the neurologic activity can be separate from any systemic flare. Okay. And all the things that the rheumatologists tell you you have to check looking for disease activity have very poor utility in CNS manifestations. Okay, so in the series that I'm leaning on for the presentation, in terms of, you know, 100 or so patients, only about half have elevated SED rate at the time of a neurologic presentation. Yes, the ANA is positive in a higher percentage and double-strand DNA. Okay. In terms of all comers, about a third have antiphospholipid antibodies. And low complement is really the minority in a severe CNS flare. So other people looked at other markers, ribosomal P antibodies, and the active split product of complement. And those things might actually be a little bit more telling than just total complement levels. Okay. The other thing that's interesting about both ribosomal P and the complement activated fragment is that sometimes they start to go up before someone gets sick, if you do serial testing, so they can actually predict a flare in a subset of patients. Okay, important thing to know about antiphospholipid antibodies is that they are associated with much more severe neurologic, mostly central nervous system disease, both stroke and seizures and dural sinus thrombosis and so, and other focal brain disease, also spinal cord disease. Okay. We'll come to imaging in a minute, but in terms of CSF, it can be quite helpful, but it's not always abnormal, as you can see, so probably less than half the time. And, you know, each of these abnormalities separately occur in about 20%, you know, pleocytosis, elevated protein, oligoclonal bands. Okay, and maybe up to 40% will have some combination of those things. EG can be abnormal, but it's usually nonspecific, something like slowing, something like that, and, you know, might or might not in a much smaller percentage show sharps or spikes. EMG and nerve conduction isn't typically done as a screening test, so it's hard to say what percentage overall have abnormalities there, but when there's a peripheral nerve clinical disorder, it has a very high yield. Okay. All right, so in terms of imaging, the ranges are pretty wide, but probably it's in reliably in the at least 50 to 60% abnormality on MRI, and there are a few abnormalities that are common. Little white matter lesions, usually in the subcortical white matter, periventricular white matter. And they are typically divided based on size into less than a centimeter, which could look like the famous microvascular disease that someone brought up in the beginning that's seen on so many MRIs. And when they're larger than a centimeter, they're assumed to be a true small infarct. A high percentage of patients, relatively high, have atrophy, and actually that is, if you do serial imaging, you can show that that's progressive and correlates with cognitive and affective disorders over time. And then a much lower percentage will have sort of very interesting abnormalities, like the man I showed you with basal ganglia and other calcifications. And occasionally we'll see this sort of nonspecific syndrome of reversible white matter pattern of vasogenic edema on MRI, which we see in eclampsia, hypertensive encephalopathy, so forth. So we also are seeing that now that we know how to recognize it in lupus patients. Okay. Now, in terms of other ways of imaging, people are interested in whether there could be some vasculopathy underlying patients who have cognitive problems, headaches, and all these neurologic things. So people have done perfusion imaging with nuclear medicine techniques. And it turns out that the yield there is actually higher than MRI. Not everyone believes this because they think there's a lot of false positives, over-interpreted studies. But in some studies, up to 90% of patients who have CNS manifestations will have an abnormal brain perfusion SPECT study. And what's very interesting is even in the skeptics will say, oh, well, there's some false positives mixed in there. But in patients who have very subtle clinical abnormalities on neuropsych testing and so forth, it will actually go away when you treat them with something like steroids. So even though it might be a soft abnormality, it can still be demonstrated to be treatment responsive. Okay. MR spectroscopy is sort of a newer tool, and people are interested in it, but we don't really have a clear sense yet. But it's probably, the numbers might actually be higher, but up to 50% might be helpful. Okay, so this is just one study, and they cleverly divided patients into those who had hypertension, where a lot of MRI findings could be non-specific, not necessarily related to the lupus, but just related to the hypertension. But you can see in the normotensive patients, the majority in this series had normal MRIs, but there was, you know, a decent number of patients with atrophy, small white matter lesions, and infarcts were the least. Okay. Okay, just in terms of how we treat, you know, obviously you will go after symptoms, whether they're depression, psychosis, pain, and so forth. And, you know, then we'll talk about for severe CNS disease using high dose steroids. Cytoxan, which is better than just steroids by itself. We sometimes will use plasma exchange and IVIG. And there are a lot of people in Europe and in Asia who actually give intrathecal methotrexate for this, and, you know, reportedly quite effective. I think around here, everyone's quite cautious, reluctant to go that far. Mycophenolate is coming into vogue, and certainly, you know, after a couple of cycles of cytoxan, one would like to get away from something that carries such a high risk of inducing malignancy over time. So people are looking at switching from cytoxan to things like CellCept a little bit earlier, once there's early stabilization. Okay. And then, you know, in the long run, sometimes Imuran, methotrexate, again, CellCept can be used. And it's very important that if patients have antiphospholipid antibodies and they have had a significant arterial or venous event, they should be on some treatment. You know, if you're not sure, if you see a few white matter dots in the brain, but no one's ever had a clinical stroke, you might just be okay with low-dose aspirin. But once you've had a significant cerebrovascular event and you have anticardiolipin antibodies, some patients evolve into a more catastrophic picture, and then you're combining multiple treatments, warfarin and aspirin, sometimes throwing everything at these patients. Okay, this is just an example of another patient from the literature with white matter hyperintensities. Okay, and this is an example of the reversible white matter disease that's been described, again, sometimes seen with eclampsia, hypertensive encephalopathy, and so forth. okay, this is a patient we follow here who is kind of interesting just in terms of overlapping symptoms. She is an EMT who I met. She was at work and started to have a migraine. She had just brought a patient to Jacoby Emergency Room, and she didn't feel well. She was having trouble speaking, having a headache, and her right arm was starting to feel heavy. And so she had a history of migraines, and she had, in fact, had migraines with focal neurologic deficits in the past. She had lupus and anticoagulant antibodies. So she also had some, you know, typical small white matter lesions, nothing that was an acute stroke. Okay. All right, so sarcoid affects the nervous system less so than lupus. Yes, of course.
So this patient came, she came readily after the symptoms.
She came what?
She came immediately after she felt the symptoms,
yeah.
The previous patient.
Mm-hmm.
So would you, thrombolyze her? I mean...
She had a history of multiple episodes like this that spontaneously resolved. And I don't remember enough about the details, but I think we elected, you know, not to, and she did fine. Okay. So about 10% of patients with sarcoid will have a neurologic manifestation clinically. When you look post-mortem, you find...
Before we go, yeah. You mentioned that headache was the most common symptom,
yeah.
With CNS lupus. When do you decide headache is, a patient who either meets some criteria for lupus or has known lupus, when do you decide headache is because of lupus and not something else, considering that's such a common complaint?
Right. It's a little bit problematic because it's a common symptom in general. I think you can make the case that if someone has a headache and they have lupus, they should have imaging just to assess what's going on. And you might look further if they have other neurologic problems in terms of like a cognitive impairment, something like that. You might even want to go as far as, you know, the nuclear perfusion imaging, CSF, and so forth. But if it's just headache, you would not... Specifically, be quick to treat that as a lupus flare with steroids or things like that. If they didn't have other active manifestations, you would go with prophylactic or symptomatic treatment. It's a murky area because migraine is a common disorder in women. Lupus, you know, again, and so you're not sure to what extent it's really a marker of CNS disease activity. Good question. Okay, so in any case, at autopsy, a higher percentage have some involvement of either the CNS or PNS. I didn't put in the number here, but it's low single digits of patients, 1-2%, that will present with a neurologic syndrome. And I'm sorry, it's probably maybe 2-3%, and even less than 1%, who will have only neurologic manifestations and nothing else. Sorry, go ahead. Okay, so these are, again, a series. So ataxia was a common symptom, and going along with nausea and vomiting, visual symptoms and headaches were also very high on the list. Diplopia from extraocular muscle problems, another common symptom. And then you have seizures, confusion, depression, and everything else. Okay. In terms of where the actual lesions were found, optic nerves had a very high yield in terms of imaging abnormalities, other cranial nerves, the meninges, ventricular system, pituitary stalk region, spinal cord, and then the brainstem. Okay, so all these areas. This is just from another series, percentage of patients and what their manifestations were. So 43% had spinal cord problems, pachymeningitis, meaning dural inflammation as opposed to leptomeningeal inflammation, was a third. Cranial nerve lesions was about a third. The white matter lesions in sarcoid can look indistinguishable from MS. So if you just have the symptoms of something that's nonspecific and you have an MRI that's also nonspecific, you have to be careful about diagnosing someone with MS. Okay. Seizures. Interestingly, we've had a couple patients who have had mass lesions, and there's one pattern that looks a lot like a meningioma. It's a fat or round dural-based enhancing lesion, and this is described as a pseudo meningioma known to happen with this. The criteria, well, how do you decide that it's sarcoidosis, and what level of certainty do you have? So definite is a clinical presentation and pathology from the nervous system, okay, and exclusion of other diagnoses, okay. So that is hard to argue with, okay. Obviously, we don't do brain biopsies in everyone. So a lot of patients will fall into these less certain categories. The probable cases have the clinical presentation suggestive, laboratory support, exclusion of alternate diagnoses, okay, and some tissue evidence, okay. And then you have possible, okay, where we're just, it's consistent with it, but we're not able to be so certain. Okay. So, again, kind of why I'm highlighting this is that a lot of us have in mind, you know, oh, well, you do this test and it's going to tell you the patient has sarcoid, okay, and so there's limits to all these tests. So chest x-rays are abnormal in the neurosarcoid series. In a pretty wide range, from 30% to 80%, most, you know, centered on up to about half. Chest CT has a higher yield, some series up to 90%. Gallium and PET scanning also a very wide range, in some series up to 95% when the CNS has active disease. Okay, what's quite disappointing is serum ACE levels. This is frequently used as the screening test, you know, to see if someone has sarcoid, and a lot of the studies really end up splitting right at about half the patients, so it's a poor screening test. Okay, when you get so far as to actively look at CSF, elevated protein is relatively common, lymphocytic pleocytosis, relatively common, oligoclonal banding, you know, the minority, but it's certainly consistent with that. Okay, so when there is central nervous system activity, the MRI is quite sensitive. Poorly, you know, specificity is very poor. Okay, but sensitivity is good. Up to 80% will be abnormal. And the patterns are, you might have an enhancing lesion, I mentioned the dural lesions, or leptomeningeal, or parenchymal. Okay, and then a third to a half of them will have these nonspecific white matter lesions, which can look a whole lot like MS. Okay. Okay. Sjogren's I bring up because of a series of cases where we've seen, mostly in the outpatient setting, patients, and there's always kind of a problem of arriving at a confident diagnosis. Okay, and I think when we go through the numbers, you'll see why. Okay, so first of all, I didn't realize, but it's a relatively common disorder because it has a very subtle or mild spectrum, but 2 to 3% of adults in some series have the SICA kind of symptoms that go along with this. If you look at what percentage of patients with Sjogren's have neurologic disease, you see a pretty wide range from single digits up to more than half. And of those, they're variable numbers, but there's a high percentage of both central and or peripheral nervous system involvement. Okay. What's very interesting, and I still am just kind of amazed by these statistics, are that the neurologic symptoms occur prior to diagnosis in the overwhelming majority of cases, 80 to 90%. And at the time of presentation, if you do a careful review of systems, the typical dry eyes, dry mouth symptoms will still only be present in less than 50%. Okay. So, in one series, they looked at how did people present. So, neurologic involvement was number one, Zika was number two, and then some articular involvement, Raynaud's, fatigue, skin, thyroid, pulmonary, and so forth. So, neurologic looked like the most common. And in this series, the central nervous system was affected in 68%, peripheral in 62%. Obviously, there's some overlap here. Okay. Now, this is from a paper that analyzed all the different peripheral nervous system disorders that you might see in Sjogren's syndrome. And so they have two forms of sensory neuropathy, an ataxic form and a painful form. If you think about the way the peripheral nervous system is set up, large proprioceptive fibers go into the dorsal column pathway, and patients who have those neurons in their axons affected will have more sensory ataxia, the small fibers that affect pain and thermal sensation will be involved in another group that have predominant pain as their symptom. Okay, you can have, again, mononeuritis multiplex, that's another pattern. You can have trigeminal or multiple cranial nerves involved, a purely autonomic neuropathy, and a reticuloneuropathy. Okay, so they, this doesn't project that well, but this is an MRI, and the dorsal columns are back here, and they're have high signal on them. And this is a postmortem slice through the cord, and you can see also there's loss of myelination in the posterior columns. This is a test of sweating in a patient with Sjogren's peripheral nervous peripheral neuropathy, and you can see that there are abnormal dermatomal or radicular areas of abnormal sweat that comes out when you look very carefully at autonomic function here. Okay. So again, we use screening tests to look for these things, and they're very poor tests. So the SSA and SSB and a lot of these large series, only the minority of patients are actually positive. Okay. So, and this has been the point where we've kind of had the discussion with Room when we've shared patients that they're kind of not impressed that it might be Sjogren's based on this, but I don't think it's a good test. Okay. Schirmer's test, where you can go to the eye clinic and ask for the little filter strips, and you can do it yourself. Doesn't take long. Measuring tear production is abnormal in a very high percentage. And there are different ways of quantitating saliva production, which might have a moderately high yield as well. Right across the street from here, there's the oral surgery clinic, and they're actually very amenable to doing lip biopsies, looking at salivary glands here. I've sent a few patients, I've literally walked patients from neurology clinic over to them, and they'll do it on the spot. It's such an easy, quick procedure. And obviously that is, you know, their criteria of a certain number of inflammatory foci in the salivary glands is considered one of the essential diagnostic criteria. Okay. All right, so those are just some references. I'd be glad to take questions if there are any. Thanks.
Sarcoid. Do you typically have like abnormal CSF functions that are
Yeah, there's correlation. Yeah, generally there's correlation. I mean, one of the issues is that we've sort of gotten hung up with, in general, with meningitis. You know, bacterial meningitis, the CSF, is so helpful and so clear-cut. With all the chronic meningitides, they tend to be more nodular or focal, sort of tethered areas of inflammation. So the lumbar CSF might not reflect what's going on at the site of the most enhancing imaging abnormality. So it's, you know, I've seen patients who had, you know, discrete areas in just one area, just one part of the brain that could be, you know, way out on the side, and a lot of leptomeningeal enhancement there, and the CSF is basically normal. So I think it just is so variable, it's hard to make any broad generalizations. Yeah?
I'm curious about the neuropsychiatric
Okay, in terms of psychiatric, well, psychosis, and there's this whole famous, you know, lupus cerebritis or lupus psychosis. And again, I think part of the impetus for this newer set of labeling these syndromes is that a lot of the old terms just didn't make any sense, and they had no connection with anything pathophysiologic. Okay, so lupus psychosis has been used as a term to describe patients who have a lot of an organic brain syndrome, which has, you know, memory impairment and affective symptoms as well. So people have lumped them together or separated them, and so the numbers vary, you know, depending on how you define your terms. But anxiety and depression, and, you know, like formal criteria, are pretty common here. Psychosis is pretty rare here, but subtle cognitive impairment is actually quite common as well. So those are. You know what I would say. Then the other thing that used to come up all the time is, you know, you have someone on steroids and they have a behavioral problem. Is it because of the steroids or not? Okay. And I think it was fairly well settled that you don't know for sure whether you can blame steroids for the psychiatric manifestations or not. But if you took a group of lupus patients who were on steroids who had new behavioral problems, it was more likely that they needed more steroids to make them better than less. You know, looked at that way, but there was no way to be sure. So you'd have to really evaluate it as a new, possible new CNS flare, and then you modify the treatment based on that data.
What point would you say that patient whom you diagnosed with lupus in the neurology clinic will be frank symptoms, or would you send someone earlier? And B, at what point do you test someone who has neurological symptoms do you start thinking?
Jurgens
as a
The first thing I do is I ask people, you know, a review of systems relevant, and it's, you know, it's something that I've just gotten into the habit of doing because I find it's amazing how many people say yes to those questions. But I think that at this point we'll sort of recommend a panel of labs in anyone with a peripheral neuropathy that isn't a diabetic, you know, to look for these causes. And again, the lab yield isn't that high, but it's relatively surprising how many SSAs do come back positive if you just start screening patients. One of the real tricky things is, of course, you know, how far do you keep going? I mean, if someone has no symptoms, they might still have a positive lip biopsy, but would you start doing a lip biopsy on everyone with neuropathy where you don't know the cause? I'm not there yet, you know. But I think it probably does make up, you know, a significant minority of those cases that we don't have a diagnosis. And so by just continuing to watch for things, you know, you might revisit it at a later time. Now, the other issue, and I kind of stayed away from treatment, but the real challenge in these cases is deciding how to treat them, because there aren't really any consensus guidelines in general. I mean, in severe CNS lupus, there have been good clinical trials saying you have to be aggressive with cytotoxic drugs and steroids. Okay, so that's not that controversial. It doesn't always work. So you still are confronted with what to do when it doesn't work. And that, you know, there's 10 different answers depending on who you ask. But in these milder or intermediate level cases who have sarcoid or Sjogren's, you know, do you really want to put someone on chronic steroids for this stuff? Well, you know, you might want to try symptomatic therapies first. You know, people are interested in things like Plaquenil, which seems to stabilize, you know, lupus patients and maybe some of these other disorders a little bit, and, you know, has less long-term side effects than steroids. But, you know, by the time you're putting someone on Imuran or methotrexate, you know, you're already introducing a little bit of a risk for them as well. IVIG is easy to propose, but it's hard to get anyone to pay for it because it's exorbitantly expensive. And again, it will work in, you know, a significant percentage of cases who have a severe, say, with Sjogren's peripheral neuropathy. It does work for those cases, but if you have a milder version of it, you have no idea whether it's worth going through the logistics of trying to try. So it's very difficult. Okay.
Thank
Thanks.
You.
I didn't email this yet.
Oh, you will?
But I can.
Okay, great.
Sorry.
Thank you so much. That's very good, actually. Very interesting.